This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day, and thanks for downloading the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. 1 year on from the Blue Mountains bushfires of 2013, we reflect on the impact of that day on Blue Mountains residents. We'll hear from Joel Hollier, whose family home was destroyed in the fires, and from RFS firefighter David Boxwell, who was deeply impacted by the destruction that unfolded around him. Plus, former New South Wales Fire Commissioner Phil Koperberg gives some tips on how to protect your home from fire. The HSC began this week. Careers advisor Wendy Gilbert talks about how to make it as painless as possible for your family. And on a lighter note, Simon Smart reviews the new Robert Downey Jr. courtroom drama, The Judge. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. It was on this day 1 year ago that around 200 homes were lost to bushfires in the Blue Mountains. And one of those who lost their family home was Joel Hollier from Winmalee. Joel's story came to our attention when he posted a note on Facebook expressing his faith in the goodness of God in spite of what was going on around him. And 1 year on, we wanted to check back in and see how things are going now. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Katrina. Thanks for
you coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to finally meet you face to face. Now, 1 year on, how have your feelings changed about that day? How are you feeling about it now?
It's hard to explain because it's still such a surreal feeling to still wake up and think of things that you don't have anymore. Like just last week, I woke up in the morning. I thought I'm going to go and pick up an instrument and it wasn't there. It was strange to think that 1 year on, it was still like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I look back on the past year and things have been really peaceful for me in the last little while. And that's something that surprises me, that a year on, I can look back and see how things have changed and see how the community has grown. And I think we're starting to see some positives come through.
When we first spoke to you, the house was still very unstable and you hadn't been able to retrieve much. I think very little, maybe just a few negatives or something like that.
Yeah.
Were there any other little treasures that turned up later?
Yeah, I told you at that stage that we had a little bunker under the house that had the photo negatives. Under there, we also found our Christmas tree. So that was a little bonus that at Christmas time we got to have our Christmas tree back.
Wow. Well, what are the things that you've missed most? You mentioned a musical instrument.
Mm. This has been part of the learning curve, I think, for me over the past year. Things are just things, that things are stuff. But I think for me, the most painful ones have been the things that have powerful memories attached to them. So in about June last year, one of my close friends passed away, a beautiful young woman. And just before she passed away, she actually gave me a couple of books and they were incredibly treasured possessions. They're no longer in my possession. And so when I think about those sorts of things are the ones that I miss. Gifts from my grandfather who passed away. Memories that I know are fading. And items which, I guess, helped me to remember those people. And I no longer have those. So it's those memories that have sentimental value attached to them that I think hurt the most to think about. All the other things are as they say, just stuff. They're replaceable. And as the years gone on, we've replaced a lot of things.
But even stuff, even clothes, for example, have memories in them, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the jacket you wore when you met your girlfriend or, you know, that CD that was playing the first time that something happened.
Of those sorts of things. It's the memories. And I realize that as part of this creation, God has, for some reason or other, created memories. And they are beautiful and they're fantastic. And we love them. And sometimes they're painful, sometimes they're good. But they're memories and they make us who we are. And we don't want to lose hold of those. And the things that we have around us just help us to reminisce on some good times.
Mm.
And it's those ones that, you really miss.
Okay. And as for the house itself, that was completely gone. I know a lot of families haven't been able to rebuild their houses because their insurance hasn't covered it. What happened in the case of your family?
Yeah, so the majority of people in our community came across some big issues with insurance companies, our family being one of them, in that council had changed the building code. And so to rebuild what we had, it was it was upwards of $100,000 more, and that's just another blow on top of all of the other blows that the community has faced. And so for our family, it ended up being a more viable option to buy a property in the area, something that was already built. And so we managed to find a really beautiful new house, which was quite close to where we lived, really close to Mum's work, and we're praising God for that, we're now settled into a really nice place, and we still have the old block of land, and not sure what we're going to do with that yet. We might wait till the market settles and rebuild something there or sell it. There's so many families in our community who still are not even at the stage of thinking of rebuilding.
Does that mean that your street essentially doesn't exist now?
There were a number of houses in our street that were taken out by the fire. Not the majority, probably just less. And so that street is still functional. It's still a street.
But there's still just some houses missing, are there?
Yeah, well, it still looks a bit like a demolition zone in places. And there's a couple of houses which are starting to spring it back up again, which is great. And it's exciting to see that starting to rebuild, but it's by no means looking like an average suburban street yet.
Now, when people go through something momentous like this, sometimes it has far-reaching consequences that, you know, you couldn't really have predicted. Have there been any big changes in your life or in your family as a result of this?
Well, moving houses, I think, is stressful enough as it is in any situation. But to rebuild and at the same time recollect all of the necessities for a new house, that's just a mentally draining task. And so that for us has been this past year kind of the predominant factor. In fact, we were talking with the family the other day about how so often we divide our lives now into pre-fire and post-fire. So you do ask, you know, is that dress new? Oh, no, that was pre-fire or post-fire. It's just another big moment in our life that we can use as a defining moment. Yeah, but little things for me surprised me. So, for example, in the fires, I lost a camera that I'd had. I loved to do filming and photography work, and I didn't touch a camera for 6 months afterwards just because it was something that I lost my confidence in. And I went to pick it up and use it again, and it was really hard to get back into the swing of things. And so now, a year on, I'm only just starting to get back into some of those things which I love to do. And that's just a little thing, but... I guess when you go through a major life crisis like that, there's going to be flow-on effects. It's a new reality which we're coming to terms with.
And how's the community going now?
Yeah, I would love to sit here and say that it's all healed and that things are going really well. But I think in some ways that would be a bit of a facade which isn't quite there yet. Rightly so. In the next weekend coming, there's a few celebrations which are going on. So there's the rebuilding of a preschool, and people are gathering together to celebrate that. And there's Thanksgiving services at a number of the churches up there to praise God for the way that things have gone in the rebuild efforts so far. But at the same time, speaking to some people, they are honest and they say, actually, we don't want to celebrate yet. There's still a process of grieving which needs to take place. There's rightly some celebrations of milestones which have been reached. But a year is not really very long in the hindsight of seeing, how many things have changed in many people's lives. And so it's going to take a lot longer. And we knew that. We knew that from day one. When things happened, we knew that we were in for the long haul, and we praise God for the way that the churches have come together around their communities, and many communities have come together to support people in the long haul. But we also recognize that, 12 months isn't quite the long haul. We still have quite a way to go. I know of people who don't particularly want to go to the celebrations yet, and that's fair enough because they're still coming to grips with this new reality, especially those for whom insurance or rebuilding has been a particularly hard battle. And I use the word battle quite strategically. It's been tough, and they don't feel like celebrating because they don't have a home yet. And so...
And I haven't been restored.
It hasn't been restored. Yeah, and their long-term reality still isn't stable. They don't know if they're living in the area long-term or moving away. So things are, a year on, they're still up in the air.
And do you think there's a fearfulness about, with summer coming? Is there a little bit of trepidation?
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me, I saw smoke the other day with the hazard reduction burning, and I got chills down my spine straight away because I didn't know where it was. I wasn't sure that it was hazard reduction. And as soon as you see that, it's a reminder, I guess. And so as we head into some of these warmer months and the winds pick up, it's a scary thing. And I guess it's a bit more real for some of us.
Yeah. A year ago, I also asked you if there'd been any encouragement through those difficulties. And how would you answer that question now?
I have seen our family grow immensely. We've grown together beautifully.
You've grown literally too, haven't you? You've had there's been a baby.
Yes, there's been
family.
A baby since then. Yep, so a new little member came along, and it was actually fantastic to have that special new member. And we had a new baby just before the fires as well. And there's something healing about having a new baby in the life of a family. It's incredibly profound. The way that the churches responded was especially powerful for me, and to see that the way that we were blessed through community up there. Was really, it was humbling to experience. And so I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about, what it means to be genuinely caring about the people around us. And as a social worker by training and seeing people grieve through experiences, it's always been very much a theoretical thing for me, but to actually experience that for myself and then to turn around and reflect on that. I feel as though, some of those sufferings that I've gone through and some of those comforts that I've received, I will be more equipped to bless other people in the future. Well, I hope I will be.
Yeah, well, you're quite young to have gone through this. It's quite a formative time in your life, really, isn't it?
Yeah, immensely so, immensely so. And when I think about it, there is so much suffering in the world. And to lose a home, that's one thing. But realistically, you look around the world and there is so much suffering. And you recognize that as humanity, we're all in this together. We're all stepping through life, plodding along, just trying to find our way. And for me, God has used situations and used this story as one of many to shape me and to shape our community. And as I said, we're starting to see some of those shoots of hope come through now.
Great. Well, thanks for coming in and sharing with us today, Joel.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to catch up with you. Joel Hollier, he's from Winmalee, and 1 year ago lost his family home in the Blue Mountains bushfires. Yeah, we've been reflecting this morning on the Blue Mountains bushfires 1 year ago, and David Boxwell was a volunteer RFS fighter who was involved in the day but also personally impacted by what happened. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you going?
Now, where were you this time last year?
This time last year, I actually was in Parramatta, and then I got a phone call from my wife to say that there was fires going down our road. She works at Warramoo, and she could actually look across the ridge and see the fires going down our road. So I took off fairly quickly. Ended up, got to the top of our road, and it was blocked by police. I showed my RFS card and said, look, I need to get through, I need to go out on a crew. Drove down the road and was just absolutely amazed by what I saw. Like a couple hundred metres down the road, there were houses gone, smoke everywhere, power lines down, red and blue lights from police and fire brigade and everything. And the further I drove down our road, which is about 4 kilometres, I fully expected not to find our house. But when I got there, our house was still standing. The garden, which was right up to the house, the bridge over the fish pond was gone. So first thing I did was get changed into my gear and go outside and start the fire pump, and basically spent the next couple of hours just putting out fires and that around the house.
So you were working on your own, really, were you, David?
I was at that point, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What were the conditions like for you fighting that fire there, like that,
well,
on your own?
The fire front had actually gone past by that stage, so it was just like the residue of everything that was still burning. I had a wood heap out the back for our wood heater. That was a light. I put it out 3 times, and the next morning it was just a pile of ash. Couldn't put that out at all. I then got a phone call from my son, one of my sons, two of them, the oldest ones, were renting a house further down the road. And he said that their house had gone up. And I thought, there's no way that his house would have gone up. I thought, if it would have been any house, it would have been ours. But fortunately, our house was spared. We found some damage on one of the veranda posts when I went to change one of the downpipes that was damaged, that was burnt into the post about 10 millimetres.
Okay. And is your house repaired now? Everything back to normal?
Yeah, everything's back to normal now. So I then raced down the road to see my son's house and got down there, and there was just nothing left.
Ah.
They were renting down there. So, but amazingly, the Christmas lights in the tree out the front were still going away.
Wow.
So, yeah, but the house was totally gone. Everything was gone. They basically had their cars and the clothes that they were wearing, and that was it.
Yeah, all right. So they would have lost a lot. Did they have some stuff at your place still?
They still had some stuff at our place. Yeah. So they moved back to our place.
Mm.
They're all in the RFS, my three sons.
Yeah.
My younger son, who was doing his HSC that year, he'd actually been called out to a stump of light from a fire that was happened 6 weeks before that was still alight, and then they got responded up to Springwood when it all went pear-shaped up there.
Yeah. How are you feeling today, David?
Relieved.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting experience. I've been in the RFS for probably nearly 30 years now. This was actually the worst that I'd ever seen.
Mm.
I didn't realise how much it was affecting me at the time, because you went to the shops and you went to work and everything was fine. I didn't realise how much it really sort of affected us.
I actually remember, David. I remember talking to you and you being quite sort of matter-of-fact about it all. But do you think now that you might have actually still been a bit traumatised?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Like, you go to work, you go to the shops, everything's normal, and then you drive back home down your road and everything's just a holocaust.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, trees, houses, just everything's just gone. A whole lot's just black. And it took about 6 weeks for about the first sign of greenery in that to come back.
Yeah. So it must have been very surreal to in one, like you said, to have those two different worlds. You know, you're going to work, you're going to, say, Sydney, everything seems normal, but you go back to your street.
And you go back to the street.
Yeah.
And one of the first things that we wanted to do was to get our garden back, you know. And we had a couple of mates and that from church and that came over and just spent some time in that there. And we spent one Saturday and we just basically redid the garden. And that was fantastic. We had a little bit of normality around us. But the thing that we really struck us was the survivor guilt. Even though we survived, we couldn't help but feel guilty that we had survived. And that was a very real thing. And, you know, I ended up, you know, going and having a chat to one of the salvo counsellors and that, because it was affecting me at work. It was affecting me, you know, family life and everything. And, you know, plus the stress, you know, we had the boys and that back living with us. So suddenly we had five people in the house again instead of three.
Yeah. So it was a lot to adjust to very suddenly.
But people were fantastic. Mm. People were fantastic. You know, and it really does bring out the absolute best in people.
Well, that's good to hear.
You know, people donating stuff from churches and that all around Australia and, you know, in the community all around the place and that, just donating, you know, funds and goods and furniture and stuff like that, and local churches that working together and, you know, putting on dinners and that for bushfire people so that they could get there and just, you know, just talk about their experience.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's something that Joel said to me as well, that that the churches did really pull together. So that's encouraging for all of us to hear that as well. So,
and I remember listening to you Sunday night on when I was out in the fire truck driving that night and had the radio on, and so I was listening to them talking about, I think it was one of the ladies, I think it was Patricia, who came up and was talking about survivor guilt, and I thought, that is just so right. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing some of your reflections with us, David.
No problem.
And we're all thinking of you today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. It's an entirely different time this year, being so cooler.
Yeah. It's probably a relief to people today, isn't it, to have a day like today?
So, yeah. If it had been a hot day, it would have brought up so much more pain and angst, I think.
Yeah. Thanks, David. Nice to talk to
you. No
worries. Okay,
thank you.
Best. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Stay with us. Got some good stuff coming up. Careers advisor Wendy Gilbert talks about how to make their HSC as painless as possible for your family. Simon Smart reviews the new courtroom drama, The Judge, starring Robert Downey Jr. And we hear from you on anaesthetic gone wrong, times when the anaesthetic didn't quite work the way it should have. That's coming up. It's almost a year since the Blue Mountains bushfires destroyed around 200 homes. And naturally, around this time, people start to get a little nervous about something like that happening again. So what can you do to protect your home from fire? Phil Koperberg is the former New South Wales Fire Commissioner. Thanks for your time, Phil.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, when we think about fire-threatening homes, of course, we tend to think of those, you know, those big raging bushfires that spring to mind. But is that actually the biggest threat to your home, or is it more common that fires actually start within the home itself?
Well, the bushfire, of course, is the one that captures everyone's attention, whilst almost every day of the week you hear or you read of a house being damaged or destroyed by fire, which invariably is not the result of a bushfire, but rather some fault within the house. For argument's sake, it could be a fault in the electrical wiring, something which people should be diligent about having checked by a qualified electrician, particularly in older homes, not so much in newer homes. The tendency to leave appliances on, whether they be clothes dryers or washing machines, a fault there, which is undetectable, could quite easily, of course, cause some internal fire. And so the list goes on, and in older properties, the accumulation of dust and mould and other things close to electrical wiring, especially if the wiring is ageing, is also a risk, as is indeed smoking in the house. Some people, of course, have a habit of wanting a cigarette in bed.
Oh, gosh.
And, well, it's true. People used to do it as a matter of course, and I suspect some still do. There are literally dozens of points of potential problems in a house, and of course the older the wiring is, the older the appliances are, then the greater the risk.
So what are some of the best ways that people can protect their home from fires? Are there some simple things we can do to reduce the risk?
Well, there's the common sense measures, of course. Don't smoke in bed. Don't leave your heater on when you're not in the house. Don't leave appliances running when you absent yourself from the house. The whole issue of ensuring that any form of heating is extinguished prior to retiring, making sure that from time to time, particularly if there are early telltale signs, lights flickering and so forth and so on, that the wiring is checked by a qualified electrician, have the fuse box checked on a regular occasion, and some of the power providers, in fact, will do this to ensure that their property, because the components of the fuse box are their property, are in good order. So it's really the exercise of common sense which will prevent and almost eliminate the risk.
Okay. And now, as we're entering bushfire season, what are some things to be aware of?
Well, what burns houses down in bushfires are two things. One is direct flame contact, and the other, of course, is ember attack, as it is commonly known. An ember attack by fire destroys the greatest number of houses in a bushfire situation.
Okay.
The object of the game is to not have combustible materials lying around the perimeters of the house, and by that I mean things like, you know, accumulated lawn clippings or raked up leaves, etc., etc. Above all, ensuring that gutters are free of combustible materials, because you can imagine a fire can be 2 or 3 kilometres away and not pose a physical threat to the house other than by ember attack.
Mm.
The wind carries the embers and dumps them in the gutters of a property which hasn't been properly maintained, and before you know it, there's a house burning 2 or 3 kilometres away from the main fire front.
Yeah, right.
So again, ensure that gutters are maintained on an annual basis, make sure they're not allowed to accumulate combustible materials, make sure that there isn't a favourite old lounge sitting on the front veranda which has got the odd bit of a tear in it and is an open invitation for a spark to deposit itself and set fire to that, making sure that verandas and subfloors are enclosed so as to prevent fires or sparks entering them.
Okay.
Again, And can I say that the best guide in the world can be downloaded from the New South Wales RFS website. They have comprehensive information, and I strongly urge anyone living in a bushfire prone area to download that information from that website.
Okay. Thank you, Phil. Just the other day, though, I saw a man throwing a lighted cigarette, but from a car window, long grass all around. I don't understand why this message isn't getting through and people are still doing this.
Well, because some people are idiots. Bluntly, I recall pulling up behind a car, the driver of which had deposited a cigarette on the roadway. I stopped, picked it up and dumped it in his lap. Now, someone would have something to say about that, I have no doubt. It's a very dangerous habit. Fires do start from ejected cigarette butts, particularly in hot, dry weather where there is grass around. And that simple, careless action, that simple, irresponsible action could well start a fire which could injure someone, cost someone's life, or destroy many properties.
Yeah, all right. Thank you for reminding us about it.
Yep. It's a pleasure.
Okay. That's former Fire Commissioner Phil Copeberg talking about ways to fireproof your home. You can read more of his tips in the Guide to a Healthy Home released by Bupa today at bupa.com.au, or read those tips on the RFS website as well. Thanks, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Over 70,000 students and their families would have woken up with a few butterflies in their tummy today for the first day of the HSC. It all starts with English this morning. And from what I hear from parents, HSC time can be almost as stressful for the mums and dads as it is for the kids. To help us through it, Wendy Gilbert is a career advisor at Covenant Christian School. She's also the founder of the YayaRevolution.com, a youth advocacy and educational program. Hi, Wendy.
Oh, hi, Katrina. How are you?
It's a big time for both parents and kids, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. A bit of a pressure cooker in some families.
So. Yep. So what are some practical ways that parents can support their kids in this time and sort of, you know, in a way that's really helpful?
Okay. I think, you know, like you mentioned stress, I think one of the things that parents can really do is not get stressed themselves, like sort of keep things in perspective and just keep things calm at home, you know, like just not have too many events going on at the same time. You know, don't be running events in your home. Just keep it nice and calm. Everyone relax. Lots of great food, healthy, nutritious food. Try and encourage, you know, exercise where possible. You know, allow them to have breaks. It's so healthy. You cannot study all day, every day, all night. It's not healthy. And you actually don't take in any more information anyway. So I think just, you know, the practicals are important. You know, if they want to go to table tennis with you or go for a walk, just be around. You know, don't put any pressure on them.
Yeah, that's good advice. But what about for parents who are feeling, you know, anxious and frustrated that their teen doesn't seem to be studying enough? One of my friends was sort of saying he doesn't seem to be doing anything. What's a helpful way to respond in that situation?
Oh, okay. It's a complex question because there's so many variables in that situation. You know, I mean, some kids give up because they feel like they're failures anyway, and what's the point of trying? You know, it's better to not try and fail than try and fail in their minds. So sometimes they're that. Sometimes kids don't try because they don't actually have a bit of a reason why they want to work. So they feel like, what's the point? You know, they get very discouraged.
Like if they haven't worked out what they want to do, that kind of thing, do you mean?
Yeah, they haven't worked out why they're doing it. What do they want to do afterwards? So it's like, what's the point? I think probably by this stage of the year, I hate to tell parents, it's probably a wee bit late in terms of you cannot make someone else work. So I would probably be focusing more on trying to think, okay, what are they good at, and looking at other options. I think probably it's better to start at the beginning of year 12 looking at, you know, trying to help them get a plan, what they want to work towards. By this stage of the HSC, look, obviously create a nice environment for them to work. They can pick up some marks at this stage and, you know, if they work over this period of time. But stressing out and trying to force them to work, you know, they'll just probably go into their room and play on their phone. If they don't want to work, it's not going to make them work.
Yeah, they've got to want it themselves, I guess.
They've got to want it. So I think, you know, trying to look at options, and parents could be thinking, what's my child interested in? And looking at all the colleges or TAFEs or things that they might look at other plans for them.
Yeah, speaking of that whole plan B thing, it's obviously going to be a lot more stressful at this time if students have just set their heart on a particular course, you know, and they feel that their whole future is dependent on getting that result. So how important is it to keep things in perspective and maybe have a plan B?
Oh, it's absolutely imperative. Like, it's really just one number. It's your ATAR. It's one thing in life, but it gets totally blown out of proportion. I mean, really all the ATAR is a rank that is the university's measure to accept people into university. And now, today, more than ever, there are so many pathways into university. It's not funny. I mean, all the universities themselves are creating pathways. There's early entry pathways, special programs within the university. So it's really, it's just got completely blown out of proportion. So what I try and do with kids that come into my office as a careers advisor, I say, okay, what do you want to do? What's your plan A? So they might say, I really want to get into international studies or something. And I say to them, okay, great, great plan. This, you'll need this ATAR, you know, well, you need to do this application, blah, blah. I say, but what's your plan B? What are you going to do if you don't get in? So help them look at other alternatives of how they could possibly get in, whether they go into another course with a lower ATAR rank, or whether they go through TAFE, or they decide something completely different. They go and do, you know, a course through a private college. Like, there's so many different pathways, and sometimes plan B can be better than plan A.
That's exactly true. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
It's just one narrow pathway. That's all it is. And life has such a myriad of pathways that we take and people we meet and things that happen. And it's just a very narrow look on life if you think this is the only thing. So I think just relax as a parent and relax as a kid. You know, just do your best. That's all you can do. You know what, Katrina, I really admire any kid that has finished high school. I think there's a lot that they face on the way. You know, health issues, peer issues, family issues. I mean, there's so many things that they face, and I really admire any kid that's got this far.
That's so true, isn't it? It's an achievement just to stick it out. So that's one good thing for parents to keep in their mind is, hey, you made it. So, yeah, good thoughts, Wendy. Thank you for that.
No worries, Katrina.
That's Wendy Gilbert. She's a careers advisor at Covenant Christian School. You can find her online at yayarevolution.com.
The infamous Hank Palmer.
The jaded lawyer with no respect for the law. Hey!
Did that just happen?
How does it feel?
Knowing every person you represent is guilty.
It's fine. Innocent people can't afford me.
All right. Is there anything either counsel care to add?
My mom passed away this morning.
Is this the first time your mother passed away, or is this something you do on all the cases you're about to lose?
First time.
Hope 103.2 Mornings with Katrina Rowe.
The Culture Collective.
It's one of the best movies I've seen for ages.
Really fun series, but it's got a great underlying message.
Guaranteed 8 out of 10.
Big-time Chicago lawyer Hank Palmer returns to his hometown to attend his mother's funeral. He's been estranged from his family and has a volatile relationship with his father, the town's judge. That's the premise behind The Judge, a new courtroom drama starring Robert Downey Jr. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity has already seen it. Hi, Simon.
Hey, Katrina.
Now, this sounds like another one of those movies, you know, where the city big shot returns to their hick hometown, which they couldn't wait to escape from when they were a teenager, usually because it was the place of some kind of traumatic incident. And then they come back and they reconnect with their childhood sweetheart. And is that part of this movie?
Well, you've summed it up nicely there, Katrina. It is a bit like that. In that sense, it does feel a bit predictable and a bit done. But despite those things, and it is, you know, sort of, you know, apple pie, you know, small town American stuff.
Yeah.
But despite all those things, this actually has some substance, this film.
Okay. I mean, I think, Simon, one of the reasons that storyline kind of pops up again and again, even though it is a bit cliched, is that I think as we get older, we do realise that those ties of family and the place we grew up in, they are quite influential on a person's whole life. Does that play out in this film?
It really does. I mean, it actually gets better as it goes. So it starts off and you're thinking, oh, yeah, I've seen this so many times. And yet, as the film progresses, it gets more complex and you start to see some of these really deeper elements to the film. I really ended up liking it. And, yeah, absolutely, that's right. This character, the Robert Downey Jr. character, has to face his family that's a bit of a mess. They have huge problems and, you know, there's all these sort of sorrows and regrets and lost opportunities. As, you know, we all know, it's part of family life, and you're right, having to face up to your past that can't ever really leave you. And I think he's tried to flee that past, but it keeps drawing him back in.
Yeah.
In this experience where he ends up having to defend his own father, who is the judge. In a murder trial, he really is drawn in back into the family. It's not all smooth sailing, though.
Okay. I think that that troubled relationship between father and son is one of the most interesting parts of this movie. What's the cause of the tension between them, and do they take steps towards healing in the film?
Yeah, I won't give away the major cause.
Okay.
Because that's sort of a
plot twist.
Plot spoiler. But it is, you know, this really hard father who's tough on his son to the point where the son grows up really longing for the approval of his father that he thinks he doesn't have. And so it's a pretty, you know, timeless story in that way. And I found it quite moving in the end. And there is a connection that does develop. The father gets very sick, and so Robert Downey Jr. is having to face that and his father's mortality. And in caring for his father, despite this, what doesn't ever get completely sort of smoothed out, it is a tough relationship. There's a tenderness to that that is, you know, it's quite affecting.
Okay, so what did you enjoy most about the movie? Was it the relationships or the courtroom drama?
Well, who doesn't love a good courtroom drama, Katrina? I think you don't get as many these days, but it's very good. And Billy Bob Thornton plays one of the lawyer, the prosecuting lawyer, and he's very good in this as well. And so that part's really good. But no, definitely it's the relational aspect to this that gets you in. Got me in anyway.
So who do you reckon would like it? Is it a good movie for blokes?
It's a good movie for blokes. Maybe that sort of father-son relationship. It gives you this, you know, we all know this, but it just touches on incredible potential for a father to do great good in his son's or his children's lives,
yeah.
But also what can happen if it's not good and the damage that occurs. So, yeah blokes, but not only blokes. I think lots of people will enjoy this.
Yeah, it is, that's an interesting way of looking at it. It is a good reminder of the importance of fatherhood, isn't it? So that would be
really
a good one
is.
For dads to see, yeah.
And Robert Downey Jr., even though he's a very accomplished lawyer, you can still see he's like the little boy wanting his dad's approval.
Yeah, don't we all? All right.
Kind of relate to that.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And you don't have to be a father to relate to that. Anyone who's had a father can relate to that. So thank you, Simon. Great to catch up with you.
Good to talk to you, Katrina.
That's Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity. We've been talking about The Judge. It stars Robert Downey Jr., Robert Duvall and Billy Bob Thornton. Well, it was National Anesthesia Day last week, and they had a very serious message for the day wanting to urge smokers to give up smoking before they have an operation because it really improves your outcomes. But with that serious message out of the way, I wanted to talk about anesthetics gone wrong. See, I had an experience where I broke my arm and I went in for surgery on my arm, and they'd given me a block and they were kind of waving my arm around like in the theatre in front of me. I could see covered in this brown stuff, and they were saying, "Can you feel that?" And I said, "No." The next minute I looked down and there's the knife cutting my arm open, and I could feel this searing, searing pain down the surface of the skin of my arm. And so I said to the doctor, "What are you doing? I can feel that. What are you doing?" Anyway, next thing I wake up high on the happy gas, and I said, like after the procedure, and I said to the doctor, "Oh, you cut me open when I was awake and I could feel it." Oh. And he said, "Doc, you can remember that? I gave you enough," insert drug name here, "to knock out a horse. You shouldn't even know your own name." So that was definitely a case of anesthetic gone wrong, because not only did I feel and see them cut me open, but I also remembered it. Now, Greg phoned in. Greg, have you had trouble with an anesthetic?
I have three stories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, pick the best one.
I had a lump on the back of my head.
Yeah?
And I was on the table waiting to be operated on, and they gave me all the injections and everything. And I'm lying there, and next minute I felt this excruciating pain.
Oh.
And I think it was the pain that actually knocked me out.
Oh, really? And was this supposed to just be a local anaesthetic, or was it you were supposed to actually be under?
I was supposed to be under. Day surgery.
Oh, no, that's terrible. Are you a redhead, by any chance, Greg?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
I was blonde going grey now.
Okay. And this has happened to you more than once, has it?
Yeah, I've had a couple of colonoscopies that I've woken up halfway through.
Oh, no. You need to seriously warn the dudes, like give me the big stuff. Give me the heavy, because I'm going to wake up.
Well, the first time I woke up, I said, "Oh, home movies."
Home movies?
Yeah. I was watching the monitor.
Oh, no. Why? That is terrible. Oh, that's terrifying me. I would hate to have that happen. And that happened to you twice in colonoscopies.
Yeah, it has.
If you ever have another colonoscopy, you need to you know, let them know.
I think I should.
Thanks for the call, Greg. See ya. Bye. Hope 1032. Hi, who's this?
This is Maggie.
Hi, Maggie. Have you had an experience with an anaesthetic?
I have. I have two, actually. One that worked way too well and the other one that didn't work at all. Which one would you like?
Oh, maybe the one that didn't work at all.
I had an abscess one morning when I woke up because I couldn't sleep through the night. There was this massive pain behind my right ear. Mm-hmm. I took myself to the doctor first thing in the morning before coffee, and I said to him, what the heck is this behind my left ear? And he said, oh, okay, we need to remove that.
Yeah.
And so he gave me an anaesthetic, a local anaesthetic with the needle into the wound on the right behind my ear.
Yeah.
And then that was the anaesthetic. And he said, okay, I'm going to do the procedure now. And I said, that's fine. And then he started slicing into the back of my ear and I could feel everything because it wasn't working yet. I could feel the blade going in. I could feel scraping.
So what did you do? Did you just say, look, stop?
I was in a lot of pain and I said to him, I can still feel that. He said, oh, really? And I'm like, don't oh, really me? I can feel everything. So anyway, I felt the entire procedure, so the anaesthetic didn't work at all.
Oh, isn't that terrible? Say,
yes, I had a very strong cocktail for breakfast after that procedure.
And what was the one that worked too well then?
Well, I fell asleep through my labour for my second child after the epidural.
Oh, right, yeah. Fair enough. So that's probably just exhaustion.
All the hard, that's right. They just woke me up to do one push and there he was.
Oh, wow. That sounds good.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks for the call, Maggie. Great to hear from you.
Pleasure.
Hope 1032. Hi, who's this?
This is Kathy. Hi.
Hey, Kathy. Have you had trouble with anaesthetic?
I woke up in the middle of a hernia operation.
Oh, no. Yeah, our boss has just had one of those. So I'm glad he didn't hear the story before he went in. That sounds dreadful. So what did you experience?
I mean, I woke up and they were tugging and pulling and I went, oh, and then I woke up in recovery. So obviously they upped what they were giving me.
Okay. And you actually remembered it though?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? It's such a strong image, isn't it? Mm, oh my
goodness. Yes. Umbilical hernia. So they were like tugging and pulling in that and I'm like, just went, oh, and then...
Was it painful though, or was it more just the shock that you'd woken up?
No, it was just the pulling sensation,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Oh, wow. Oh, unpleasant. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.